I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Apollo 14 lunar module pilot Edgar Mitchell is one of only a dozen men to walk on the surface of the moon.
To be on the moon, be on a place in the universe where we hadn't been before, nobody else had been, and that was an exciting part.
His mission, which included 2 days on the moon, was in the shadow of the disaster-stricken Apollo 13 mission. I'll speak to Mitchell about his new book, Earthrise, which chronicles his career as an astronaut, the successes of Apollo 14, and what he thinks of the future of space exploration. But first, a budget airline's plans to offer low-cost flights between Orlando and Norway is coming under fire. Norwegian Air International is offering the low-cost flights, but the Airline Pilots Association is urging federal regulators to take a closer look at the company's operation. To talk more about the pilots' concerns, I'll speak to the association's airport and ground environmental chairman, Steve Jangelis. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by First Officer Steve Jangelis. He's the Airport and Ground Environment Group Chairman for the Airline Pilots Association. Steve, thank you very much for coming in.
Happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Well, first of all, pilots are obviously protesting the support of the likes of Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer and his push to allow Norwegian Air International, it's a low-cost carrier, bring flights to Orlando International Airport. What are the concerns that pilots have?
Well, the largest concern is that we're not concerned so much with the competition issue, and we applaud the mayor, both Mayor Jacobs and Mayor Dyer, as well as the airport director and airport chairman, to invite low-cost travel to Orlando. I am an Orlando resident, and I share in the tax base as well, and I think more and more tourism and more ability for businesses to expand here based on that tourism is important. The main issue that we see as airline pilots is that this is not an airline in the traditional sense. It is an airline that is being built on what is called a flag of convenience. And what that means is that you have other carriers that fly from overseas and they come here, such as British Airways, Virgin. They just recently announced a new carrier that's not very new, but it's new to Orlando International, Thomas Cook Airlines, which flies charter folks. They were landing at Sanford, and now they're landing at OIA. These airlines have been established using their current country's regulations and labor standards. So when these airplanes leave their country, fly here to the U.S., they return to that country. The difference between that and the Norwegian Air incident is that Norwegian Air is going to establish an airline in Ireland, but never fly to Ireland. Now, the way the laws are written and the international treaties are written, Ireland is responsible for the oversight of that airline. And if the airplanes never travel or the pilots never see that country, how can we guarantee that that airline's going to be safe when they're crossing large ocean?
Mm-hmm. What about the issue of pay? I know that in the United States, for example, that there have been stories in the past about, you know, concerns about pilots being paid a good wage for what is a kind of a stressful and challenging job. Do you think, for example, Norwegian Air pilots would get paid a decent wage comparable to what they would earn here?
Well, the issue that we see with Norwegian Air has what's called Norwegian Air Shuttle, which was their original operation. And in fact, the CEO just faced a strike from his pilots over this new organization where basically he's going to offshore all of his flying to this international operation in Ireland. He's going to keep the Norwegian pilots flying. But the reason why he moved to Ireland was because the Norwegian Air Shuttle certificate, as it was issued by Norway, had labor laws and pay rights and vacation rights and things that are governed by law, whereas here in the United States, we govern that with collective bargaining, meaning we negotiate with the company and it's overseen by the National Labor Relations Board. Mm-hmm. So to start moving around to try to shop around for convenience could lead to a lower standard in wages, lower standard in work rules. And quite frankly, it's interesting. It's the way of the cruise ships.
Right. What about other airlines, though? I mean, are there other kind of comparable airlines that are already doing things like this where you can point to it and say, look, their record's a bit spotty. There's already a bad precedent for this kind of thing?
There has already been an accident, which ironically happened in Ireland. Right now, this currently is not on the books for – this is the first for the aviation industry, and we're a fledgling industry. We're 80 to 90-some-odd years old, and we're starting to now see this where the – shipping industry has been around for hundreds of years. So this is why we're taking a large look at this. And the reason being is that there is an instance, there is some history of this sort of scheme being dangerous for its passengers. Ironically, the Irish Department of Transportation issued an accident report in late January from an accident that happened months earlier of a commuter airplane that was flying between Belfast and Cork, but it was using a Spanish-regulated airline registered there in Spain using Spanish pilots and using an Irish ticket broker and an Irish internet ticket seller. And when the Irish Department of Transportation reviewed this crash, it was an unfortunate incident as they were coming into land. Six people perished, six people lived. And as they did the resultant study, they found that ironically, the Irish Department of Transportation said there was a lack of oversight from a Spanish carrier operating inside of Ireland. Mm-hmm. So if it's already been out there, and the reason being is they said there was no oversight over the training standards, there was no oversight over the maintenance of the aircraft, and this is just on a small propeller regional route. We're not talking a large twin-engine jet crossing an ocean. So there's already a standard set. But as far as this being a current practice in the aviation trade, no, this is brand new, this idea.
What about the issue of where these planes will be serviced and maintained? Do you know much about what's going to be happening there?
Well, this we do not know. This has not been divulged by Norwegian Air at the time. What happens is with my airline, my airplanes come in and they're overseen by a maintenance inspector who certifies the facility. And by all means, I think that Norwegian will use certified facilities. But when will the Irish government get out there and inspect and verify and take a look at the records? At any time, we have a great regulator here in the United States. I definitely want to say nothing but good things about the FAA and the Department of Transportation and all their work they do keeping us safe. We're very satisfied with that. And the reason why we have a very safe system here in the United States and North America, Canada, for that matter, is because we have a very strong regulator who can review logbooks, who has the power to go ahead and inspect pilot training and see things like that. So that sets us above the rest of the world. And I think we have the best regulator in the world right now.
Mm-hmm. What are the rules, though, when you're looking at what kind of oversight the FAA does have for foreign carriers? I mean, what sort of regulations do they have to follow when they're flying to and from the United States?
Well, let's be honest. Basically, the FAA can do the equivalent of, for boaters that are listening, basically check how many life vests are on board. They have no further oversight than to say, we want to see all, they could take a look at the aircraft logbook. They could ask for the pilot's licenses. They could make sure that there's no outstanding maintenance items that are on the airplane. And that is it. An airplane has millions and millions of moving parts. They don't get into the nooks and crannies to see what's in there. And also the pilot training issues. As we've seen, pilot training and pilot flying has been a hot button topic. The FAA can't come in and say, well, have you had your simulator training recently? No. All they can do is check licenses and documents. And I've been on the receiving end of that in foreign countries as well. And that's their most ability. So when the airport director was responding in an op-ed editorial that, well, we trust the U.S. government will give proper oversight for this airline, the majority of that oversight is when the airplane lands, licenses, documents, certificates of insurance, and that's it, and have a nice day, and they can fly back across the ocean. So to provide a deep dive into their maintenance and ops procedures, that's only hosted by the regulator.
We're talking to First Officer Steve Jangalis. He's the Airport and Ground Environment Group Chairman for the Airline Pilots Association. I'm Matthew Pitty. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. You can join the conversation online. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Steve, I'm wondering too, in terms of safety, I mean, these modern airliners, I know there's been a lot of media attention given to them in the last couple of weeks with the disappearance of that Malaysia Airlines plane. But in general, they're very, very safe, like a lot more perhaps than they would have been, say, 40, 50 years ago. Do you think that sort of sways or kind of tilts the ledger in favor of the lower cost airlines? Like you could fly some of these modern planes and not have any issues for a long, long time just because they're so well built.
Absolutely. We've seen in history, if you remember, there was a ValueJet crash in 1996, and there was a large issue with low-cost carriers that they didn't have the oversight. And there was a large migration of the consumer to avoid a low-cost airline and fly them at no cost. And they were passengers were very concerned with that as a safety situation. So they migrated to the larger airlines. Well, as we can see now, you have JetBlue, you have Southwest, you have Spirit Airlines. You have large established carriers that are safe. And yes, the technology has made them safer. That's not to say that what happened with that value jet crash was caused by pilots or by the technology of the airplane. It was an oversight situation with hazardous materials. But as you could see, the unfortunate result was that folks migrated to the larger airlines. And a case in point is that, you know, they'll be flying either U.S. or French-built airplanes in Airbus or another type of manufacturer. And, yes, those aircraft are perfectly safe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the issue is, we take a look at the mayor's, Dyer and Mayor Jacobs, as well as the airport's appeal to try to get this low-cost traffic. I would appeal back to them and say, would you allow folks flying in and out of OIA to get a bus that's purchased in Seattle – but use a driver who's licensed in Venezuela, who has license plates in Mexico, but by the way, does the maintenance up in Canada, would they allow that to happen? It's very hard to find out and figure who's responsible for that bus service. A bus can just pull off the side of the road. An airplane cannot.
Mm-hmm. To play devil's advocate a little bit, though, I mean, do you think passengers really think about things in the way the Pilots Association, for example, people who have a little more inside knowledge would think about it? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, the cost of a plane ticket, people will just go online and say, I want the cheapest ticket I can get. I'm not really too concerned about thinking about safety and that kind of stuff now. I mean, air travel has become so commonplace. You can just hop on a plane like you would a bus or something.
Well, let me tell you, that is a victory for our industry. We can take a look at our safety records, and they have been excellent, especially here in North America. Now, worldwide, they are lagging behind us because we have such a strong regulator, but you're absolutely right. We have to play the power of the click, meaning the click of the internet mouse as they search for an airfare. Obviously, a person will look at the airfare and say, wow, this is a great deal. And there is a little bit taken for granted of who's actually doing the flying. And so much so that the Department of Transportation a few years back made sure that when you were flying in the U.S. and you were flying on what we call a regional or a feeder carrier for a larger airline, that had to be disclosed to the passenger, that you're flying with this carrier and you're free to look at their records and find them online and do things like that. So have we seen passengers migrate away from a situation where it's the cheapest fare? No, they're going to get the cheapest fare, but they take for granted the safety risks that are involved. And right now, aviation is safe. Ask yourself the question, and I hate to say this and speculate, but are folks running to Malaysia right now to go buy tickets? They've seen a strong drop in their traffic and travel just because of an unfortunate accident that we know nothing about right now. There is no probable cause, but folks are migrating away, according to recent media reports, that folks are booking away from that airline. Mm-hmm. So we've taken safety for granted in this world. And what we want to do is our industry, we represent 53,000 pilots, and we want to raise our hand and say, hey, let's make sure this operation is safe.
Well, we did actually reach out to Mayor Dyer's office, and also we reached out to the Greater Orlando Aviation Authority. We haven't heard back from them yet, but we did get this statement from the City of Orlando, and I'm just going to read it. International air service is vital to the City of Orlando. It's also very important to the broader Central Florida economy, whose number one industry is tourism, worth more than $52 billion annually. Accordingly, one of Mayor Dyer's top economic priorities is to support increased international flight options at Orlando International Airport, which drives significant economic activity in Central Florida while creating and supporting tens of thousands of jobs. And I know, Steve, you said before that you have nothing against the idea or the basic kind of concept of low-cost flying. I'm just wondering, though, do you think there could be an argument made that having a low-cost international carrier of the likes of Norwegian Air International would actually boost traffic at Orlando International Airport and then lead to perhaps additional jobs for pilots and crew?
It could very well. We do not know Norwegian's plans and what they're looking to do, but they are purchasing upwards of around, I believe, 200 787 airplanes, mm-hmm. which are manufactured here in the United States.
Sure.
And one great thing to point out is when we start talking about jobs, when an airplane from a foreign carrier arrives, usually they contract out those services. And when that airplane arrives, it's very hard for just one flight a day to hire a full staff, a full crew, a full catering company. So those jobs that they're touting as saying these are going to come with the arrival of Norwegian Air are probably already established here. Now, will there be more man hours? Absolutely. And And I think it's great for the economy that we do get more travel here. And I think, like you said, we discussed earlier, Ryanair or other foreign carriers, established carriers flying in and out of the country that they're registered is very important. I mean, a fact that jumps out at me is that, you know, our airline industry employs 151,000 workers, just the U.S. airline industry alone, on transatlantic operations. Now, if we were to have these airlines come over that are offshoring, trying to find the cheapest way out or the quick carve out to try to get around labor laws, these pilots and flight attendants that are going to be employed are going to be on temporary contracts. So there's nothing to say these are permanent. I have a retirement plan being put aside in a 401k setup, which means that my airline thinks that I'm going to be there till I retire. And hopefully I will be. But the thing is that there is a future there. But when you're told you're going to have a temporary term or a temporary contract, as they've led on, that doesn't support a permanent position. So as you could see, they're just sort of saying, well, we're just going to set this up and offer temporary contracts. So I applaud the mayor for trying to stimulate traffic. And of course, it does help the local economy. And I understand and appreciate that entirely. But we have to make sure it's on the level and safe.
What kind of pilots do you think they would get? These low-cost carriers, who flies for them?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because as there have been other media reports about the shortage of airline pilots. Regional airlines right now, who are the lowest paid inside the United States, are having trouble attracting pilots. One carrier this week just announced a $12,000 signing bonus to anyone that comes to one of their courses to try to be a pilot there. But when you take a look at the inverse assignment of that is that their pay is very low. Mm-hmm. It's the average regional airline co-pilot starts at $20,000 a year.
And they have pretty quick turnaround times, too, I suppose.
And they do. And the thing is that, you know, you're asking a person who basically goes out and gets a college degree, who then goes to flight training and adds the equivalent of a doctorate as far as their work study, because they have to do the flying on top of just getting a degree or going through a training program. And you're asking them to come out and make, let's just say, very close to poverty wages. And some pilots I know are on food stamps. So right now the industry is seeing a shortage, and we're going to have a large retirement wave here in the United States. Now, that being said, you're not seeing pilots leave larger established carriers to go to fly for upstarts such as Norwegian. Airlines around the world are having a tough time finding pilots. And when you have a stack of applications that are out there, the best airlines are going to attract the best talent based on the best pay, best wages, best work rules. And it's just going to be literally a law of supply and demand. So the pilots that they're going to be able to attract, I'd be suspicious to say that they're going to get the best that are out there. A lot of the other carriers are hiring, including the U.S. established carriers here. And there are folks that are flying overseas who are hoping they could come back to fly in the United States. So we're a very attractive industry over here based on our pay, quality of life, and work rules. Mm-hmm. And this situation would attract folks that probably aren't as experienced.
Just a couple more questions. I mean, there's been a bit of back and forth between the pilots and the city and also the Orange County and letters sent to the United States Department of Transportation. Do you see a compromise in the future? Do you think basically the city and the county are pretty entrenched in their position of wanting to attract this carrier?
We believe so. We've reached out to them to have a discussion over this and to try to educate both Mayor Jacobs and Mayor Dyer and have a discussion. We've had an editorial op-ed duel in between myself and the airport folks. I understand their position, and we respect it. And I think it's great that they're trying to grow Orlando, bring more jobs here, better the economy. But what we'd like to do is educate them on exactly what the implications are of their support of this DOT application.
How long do you think it will take before this is resolved?
The U.S. Department of Transportation can rule on this at any time. And right now they're reviewing the application. And that is why we're being very vocal as pilots. Also, flight attendants are involved, larger airlines involved. And that makes people point the finger and say, well, you're just trying to eliminate the new guy and try to get them out. And that's not the case at all. But to answer the question, it could be imminent. It could be months. We aren't sure on it. It's just handed down from the Department of Transportation, their application to fly here.
I've been speaking to First Officer Steve Jangalis. He's the Airport and Ground Environment Group Chairman for the Airline Pilots Association. We've been talking about the possibility of Norwegian Air International, a low-cost carrier, bringing flights to the Orlando International Airport. Steve, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Up next, a conversation with Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell. Joining me by phone is Edgar Mitchell. He was the lunar module pilot during the Apollo 14 mission and the sixth person to set foot on the moon. His book, Earthrise, chronicles his life and his journey to the moon. Edgar, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, the Apollo 13 crew, following two successful moon landings, they encountered quite a bit of trouble while trying to land on the moon, to say the least. The crew was almost lost. When you were preparing for the Apollo 14 mission, only 4 months after that ill-fated Apollo 13 mission, what was going through your mind?
Well, we need a little background here. Apollo 13 was originally my mission because of the process that we had at that point in time. And because Gordon Cooper, who had served backup on Apollo 10, decided to retire, he had had enough, and Alan Shepard, who had been grounded for some time due to an inner ear problem and who had that corrected, wanted to come back on flight status. And that meant actually that we were in line to go on Apollo 13. But headquarters in Washington said, Alan, you haven't been in the training loop for some time with your medical problem. Best you take a little more training time. So they forced a switch between our crew and Jim Lovell's crew, which was then Apollo 14. So we took 14, they took 13. They got a bad machine. We got a good machine. And we actually flew the Apollo 13 mission. We just called it Apollo 14.
Were you nervous at all setting out on that mission, knowing what had happened with Apollo 13?
Well, we did more than that. You see, we helped decipher what happened, what failed on the Apollo 13 mission. And we went to the particular plants that manufactured the parts that were associated there, and had pep talks and went over the procedures at those factories to make sure that the procedures were now smooth enough that it wouldn't happen again. And so that was our contribution to that. It was an awfully good team we were working with, and everybody was sincere about making it happen. You know, just a matter of perfecting little bits and pieces here and there to make sure nothing failed, nothing was overlooked, and we had all of the proper things in place.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the Apollo 14 mission, there were also a couple of issues. You had a bit of trouble docking with the lunar module and also an abort error in the final moments of your landing. Can you just explain what happened there?
Well, this is in retrospect. We'll never be able to prove this. But we had a rain shower shortly before we launched. And that rain shower probably got a little bit of moisture in the docking mechanism, which as we launched froze the docking mechanism so that when we tried to dock for the first time in space, the initial latch simply was frozen up and didn't work. But our solution was we retracted the initial latching mechanism, and Stu Roosa drove us right in to allow the final latching mechanism to be in place, which was good driving. I mean, he read right on target. Mm-hmm. And it worked perfectly. So we had our dock. We just had omitted one step, the initial docking mechanism that would have made it a little easier to dock. But nevertheless, we solved that problem and went right on. So you see, that's what simulation and what we did. Practice on the ground. Everything that we needed to do in space to make sure we understood all the parts and pieces and the procedures, so that if something happened, we had a backup to overcome it.
Do you think, is that sort of one of the most important skills of astronauts, the ability to solve problems that might not have been foreseen, though? Because you talk about, you know, practicing for every kind of eventuality, but it seems like there's got to be sometimes, it's such a complex thing to go to the moon or anywhere in space, really. Like, you really have to be on your game and be able to think your way through tricky problems, which are really life and death situations.
That's what our training was all about. We trained and trained and trained on each part of the mission till we had it down what we thought was perfectly, and practiced and practiced till we could do it blindfolded, as it were. And that's what made the missions all successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're one of just 12 people to walk on the moon. Can you describe the experience?
Well, it was a great experience, and as I said, we practiced everything we were supposed to do in the simulators on the surface at Cape Kennedy, in the pressure suits. We simulated and practiced everything we were going to do so that we had it down pat. And it was just a matter then of when we got to the moon, even though it was a new environment, everything was had been practiced enough that it really weren't any great surprises. So we went through the motions of doing what we had to do and what we'd practiced doing. And fortunately, that was sufficient, and it was, of course, an exciting procedure for each of us to be on the moon and be on a place in the universe where we hadn't been before, nobody else had been. And that was an exciting part. But the main part was to keep doing our job and get it done in the time allotted, because we were had a certain amount of time we were supposed to do it, and go through all the procedures. And we had little things happen. Little things didn't work right, but we were skilled enough that we were able to overcome them.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Edgar Mitchell. He was the lunar module pilot during the Apollo 14 mission. He also helped bring back the crew of the stricken Apollo 13 mission when they were marooned in space. And he's the sixth person to set foot on the moon. His book Earthrise chronicles his life and his journey to the moon. Edgar, I want to ask you now a little bit, excuse me, about the book. You've written it for a young adult audience. What do you think? Obviously, the time is different now from it was back in the late 50s and 60s, but do you feel like there is the same interest from young folks in getting into careers in space, becoming astronauts these days?
Well, I think so, because it's another avenue of exploration that we humans have during this last 40 years since we went to the moon. But and now we're talking about going to Mars. We're sending missions to Mars, unmanned missions, but we're talking about sending manned projects there.
The idea of going to Mars and, you know, in the 2020s, as the current administration is talking about, do you think that has a good likelihood of translating into action? I'm just wondering if there's the same kind of foresight and vision now that there was back in the 60s that allowed the space race to get astronauts to the moon. Do you think there's the same kind of drive that can get people from here to Mars?
Oh, yes. I think that we are looking in those directions. There are people with the means and with the desire and have the burning desire to go do it. And in due course, we will do it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that would be more likely to come from a private sector source or from a government-funded agency such as NASA?
Well, let's hope that they work hand in hand, and we can certainly use government expertise and funds to do so. But you don't have to be in the government to have creative ideas and be well educated and understand some of these problems and try to live in a sustainable way. So why not instead of being either or, why don't we do it jointly?
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to Edgar Mitchell. He's an Apollo 14 astronaut. We've been talking about his book Earthrise and about his philosophy about space. Edgar, thank you very much for speaking to me.
You bet. Good to talk to you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.